You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The nonpartisan primary election for the superintendent of public instruction, Wisconsin's top education post, that is 2 weeks away. Seven candidates are running in the primary ahead of the April 6th general election. And next up in our candidate interviews is Sheila Briggs, an assistant state superintendent for the Division for Academic Excellence at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. What do you want to know about her priorities for public schools in our state? It's 800-642-1234. Sheila, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's begin with why you want this job to be the next state superintendent.
Thanks. So I began my 30-year career as a kindergarten teacher. Then I became a principal and later worked in the central office in Madison as an administrator supporting 32 elementary schools. I really couldn't have imagined leaving until I got a phone call from Tony Evers and he asked me to serve in his cabinet. And I have been spending my entire career really fighting for our public schools and for equity for all of our students. And we still have a lot of work to be done. And so I am very eager to continue as the next state superintendent because I want to continue that work. I think we need to stop chasing test scores. It is actually hurting our kids and our test scores are actually going down because of it. We really have to stop demonizing our teachers. We need to get back to supporting them and providing them with the things that they need to be able to do their job. And finally, the way we fund our public schools just isn't working. And so I am very eager to continue building upon the work that I've started. I have deep relationships across the state and I know how to get things done. And so I know it's going to be challenging, but I'm going to be ready to lead the department on day one.
Let's go back to number one on your list, equity. How do you address Wisconsin's enormous racial and economic disparities that divide student achievement across our state?
Yeah, it's an excellent question, and it is the most important issue that we have to be addressing. I've spent my entire career working on this. In fact, when I was a principal in the Madison School District, we were able to take our third grade reading scores from 58% proficient or advanced to 100% of our third graders reading. I know how to do this work. I know how to get it done. At the state, I've also been leading in several areas where we're getting results in closing racial achievement gaps. I'll give you one example. We've been focusing on making sure that all of our teachers have access to really high quality instructional materials that are aligned to the standards that we're teaching. And in the places where we've had success in shifting the way our schools and districts are approaching reading and math, we're seeing increased student achievement, but especially for the kids that are farthest behind, they're growing the fastest. And on top of it, we're also hearing from teachers that they are finding newfound joy for teaching, which is also really important to me because we need to mitigate the teacher shortage that we're facing in Wisconsin. And so that tells me we're doing the right things because teachers are telling us that they are seeing increased student engagement and success for all kids, which is exactly what we're working for. And so that's one way that we're going to continue working on making sure everybody gets the access to the best instruction available so everyone can be successful.
We're talking with one of the seven candidates running for state superintendent. Sheila Briggs is an assistant state superintendent at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction, DPI. You can join in with your questions for her, 800-642-1234. Sheila, students are falling behind amid the pandemic. Being able to stay on grade level through all of this virtual schooling and is very, very difficult. As you look at the pandemic and it continues, when do you think schools should be holding instruction virtually? When should kids be in the classroom?
Yeah, I think, first of all, let me just say this has been a challenge for everyone throughout this pandemic. I guess that's why they call it a crisis. It's been hard on our kids, that's for sure. It's been incredibly challenging for our teachers to continue to be able to pivot from remote instruction to in-person instruction and sometimes back to remote instruction. And certainly our parents have really had to step up and be incredibly supportive of our children as they're trying to continue learning through this crisis. I think there is no question whatsoever that we can never replace the importance of having our children, you know, together face to face with each other and with their teachers. I think we're all working as hard as we can to make sure that we can get back to that. I think there's a couple things we need to make sure happens. First of all, we need to make sure our teachers are getting access to the vaccine as soon as possible. We need to make sure that they are safe. We need to make sure our children and the families that they're going back to are safe. And so that needs to be a priority. We also need to be making sure that all of our teachers and schools have access to protective equipment to make sure that when they are in person, that can also be done safely. And then I think, finally, we have to make sure that as a community, we're really prioritizing this idea of having our children back to school and in person with their teachers. And so we all have to just collectively make sure we continue to do things like, you know, wearing our masks so that we can keep the virus under control as much as possible in the community so that we can be successful in having everyone safely back to school.
How would you change Wisconsin's funding formulas that determine how much state support goes to schools each year?
Yeah, there is no question that our current funding formula is not working. We really shouldn't have a system that is designed around the amount of property wealth behind a kid. We really have to fund our schools based on what kids need. And we know that some kids cost a little bit more to educate, and we need to be willing to put forth additional funding to do that. For example, our special education funding is woefully inadequate. We have about a $1 billion gap in funding to support our special education students. And we also know that that doesn't just hurt our special education students. It hurts all students because we end up drawing funding away from the general funding formula. So that needs to change. We need to be reimbursing our districts for a minimum of 60% of their special education costs. And we really need to shoot for even higher than that. We're also woefully underfunding the support for our English learners. So we are reimbursing less than 10 cents to every dollar there. And again, that is something that impacts our entire population of students. And then finally, I would just say, we also take $385 million right off the top and send that to private voucher schools. And I think it's about time that we look at making sure that we are meeting our constitutional obligation to fully fund our public schools. And so I think all of that needs to be relooked at.
Would you take funds away from voucher schools?
I think that we have been going down this path of voucher schools for several decades now, and we're just not seeing results. It is time for us to really rethink how we are funding our public schools. And so certainly we can't pull the rug out from under the children and the families that are currently attending schools. It's certainly my job to support all children across the state of Wisconsin, but it's time for us to relook at the funding formula.
Sheila, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Sheila Briggs is an assistant state superintendent for the Division for Academic Excellence at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. Coming up, we have another candidate vying to become Wisconsin's next state superintendent of public instruction. What questions do you have for Troy Gunderson? What do you want to know about his positions or past work? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We continue our candidate conversations ahead of the nonpartisan primary election for the superintendent of public instruction. The primary is set for February 16th. Seven candidates are in the race ahead of the April 6th general election. And now we have Troy Gunderson, an adjunct faculty at Viterbo University in La Crosse and a former superintendent of the West Salem School District. What do you want to know about his priorities for public schools in our state? It's 800-642-1234. Troy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate, and thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So explain why you want this job to be the next state superintendent.
Well, I spent 35 years in public education and grew up in a little town called Colfax in northern Wisconsin. And my mother's a teacher, and my wife's a teacher, and father-in-law's a teacher. And So like everything that we have and all the opportunities I've had in my lifetime have been connected to public education. And at the end of my career, I decided it was time for me to step up to the plate and give something back. So I'd like to serve the entire state. And I think what separates me from the other candidates is I have connections in all four corners of the state. And I think I have the ability to bring the state together and for the common purpose of serving children.
What are your top priorities for the job?
Well, my top priorities would be having the state ready to lead, which is connecting us to all of the state into an opportunity or an exercise where we really redefine how public education is going to play a role in moving the state forward. And underneath that, students ready to learn, which is about serving kids and their families, making access to early childhood programming and mental health and equity and all the issues that go around students. Teachers ready to teach is investing in how to find the next generation of teachers and making sure the career stays viable for everybody. And then if we get all that right, we should produce future ready graduates, kids who are career, college, and life ready so that they can become productive citizens of this great state.
The pandemic has been a huge hit to education in our state. As you know, when should teachers and students be in the classroom? When should class be held virtually? How do you negotiate that?
Yeah, I think it's all about using the metrics and the data from the experts in terms of safety. We really have to, now that we're in this deep, make sure we're providing vaccinations for our teachers. But studies have come out showing that the process and the protocols around protective personal gear for kids and teachers really has been able to keep kids safer. And as long as the experts are telling us what protocol to follow and how to stay safe, we should be able to follow their guidelines. I think that's the key for me, is that we have avoided taking the input from experts and then following it. We need to have leadership in Madison that provides a sort of a rubric for each part of the state, and so that as you look at the data that's impacting your kids, both in your community and your school, you know where the safety line is. And there's people who are experts in communicable diseases that know where those lines are, and we should be following their advice.
What would your plan be to help students get caught up? They're falling behind grade level. How do you catch them up?
Yeah. Well, I think we should be really looking at what we're doing in summer school this summer to be able to give kids opportunities to get back. And then I think it's about assessing, what's happened from the pandemic. I mean, I think, everything that we talk about in terms of achievement and access for kids somewhat has been speculative. And I think that's where the DPI's leadership role would be, is to help collect the data from both nationally and around our state to know, what impact has been on families and children in terms of emotional and academic progress, and then strategize a plan for closing that gap back up and getting folks back on track moving forward. I think is really something that we could do as a team again. I look at the approach to all of these types of issues in Wisconsin as a team, using our cooperative education service agencies and the DPI to develop a strategy to roll that out. So we collect the data, we know where we're at, we develop a strategy, and we move forward. And I think the DPI has to facilitate that leadership and provide direction for all the people who are connected.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with one of the seven candidates running for state superintendent. Troy Gunderson is an adjunct Viterbo University instructor of school finance, former superintendent of the West Salem School District. Taking your questions, 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about his goals, his qualifications? What do you want to see out of DPI as an agency going forward? Call in. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Let's bring in Francisco joining us from Sister Bay. Hi, Francisco.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
Are you aware that we are still funding the public schools according to the Constitution of 1848? That from the real estate tax, we get money to pay for the police, to pay for schools, to pay for the everything municipally. Everything that the municipals do need, we pay out of the real estate tax. And it is unconstitutional for people who come here and make billions of dollars to pay a single penny for maintaining the municipalities.
And Francisco, I'm going to jump in here. Troy, how would you change Wisconsin's funding formulas for higher ed? I'm sorry, not for higher ed, for public schools.
Well, there's a couple things about that. The property tax thing, things that Francisco is alluding to, are, you know, part of attempting to add stability to the system. But I think he's right in that we've been too reliant on that. I would take the current system. Has to be, first off, the amount of funding into the equalization aid formula was declined, frozen for so many years in a row that it forced people to conduct referendas, which then adds more to the property tax and further adds to the inequity. So we need to first add more money to that to raise the revenue limit base. And the second thing is some children are more expensive than others. And so we've really lost our way in that part of the game.
What do you mean by that? Some children are more expensive than others?
Well, special education children, some of them cost more than other students, and we aren't funding that at what the rate we should be. Children who need English language learner services, children who need mental health services, children who are homeless. And I think there's ways in which you can identify the children that fit into different categories of additional expense and layer that over instead of providing straight per pupil aid to districts that we currently do. So we get the current model. It needs to be layered over on what's called a categorical per pupil expense, depending upon the category piece, and then additional funding for special education, which is a way in which you add more money to all of the other services because you have to spend that money first. And then when you look at the whole state funding formula, where do you get the additional money from? We're just dumping an enormous amount of money into the voucher program for private schools who in most cases aren't near as competent as the public schools are in terms of using that money. So there's money there if we can reorganize it. I think that's what his question is why are we so reliant on property taxes? And I think there should be a better distribution of that money from other sources other than property tax.
So which schools in your vision would receive more funding?
Well, places where they have more free and reduced kids, more English language. So if you look at just, in my area of the state, you look at the school district of La Crosse, they have about half their kids on free and reduced lunch, but in West Salem, only about a quarter. They have more special education kids. So if we talk about their baseline funding, and then over and above that would be based upon the number of children that fit into those categories that you have. Currently, and during the last decade, the folks in Wisconsin came up with a per pupil categorical aid that they just gave for every child. And so kids in the school district of Whitefish Bay is getting the same as Milwaukee. The school district of West Salem is getting the same as La Crosse. And the kids don't fit in the categories that are the same expense. We have to accept the fact and take that into reality to be able to better fund, because we're not serving these children, our neediest children.
And let's talk about equity here for a moment. How would you address Wisconsin's enormous racial and economic disparities that are dividing student achievement across our state?
Well, the economic ones we just talked about, because really, if you look at the state on a whole, the suburban school districts are the ones who win in the current model, and in the urban districts and the rural districts are the ones who are where the inequity is. They are unable to provide the same kind of services that you can in the suburban places where they have money. The racial equity issues is about, I think, awareness on our part and a willingness to step up and do that. We've got a 100-year history in Wisconsin of being unwilling to do that in certain areas. And that's just something that we have to be able to have that crucial conversation, talk about moving that forward. And just from an internal piece, it's about, culturally aware teaching and being willing to say not everyone looks the same and not everyone requires the same approach. And until and unless we're ready to accept that and work together as a state and accept that the changes or the differences in equity are the same, we have issues all over the state. It's not just a southeastern Wisconsin problem. It's not just a northern problem or a western problem. Is all of us, and we have to make that our focus. And that's what I talked about earlier about ready to lead. We have to pull the whole state together to focus on that issue, because the data and the results and our status as a nation or as a state in this nation just depend upon it. What we've done to
how would you address the curriculum? What changes would you make
to to the curriculum? Well, I think about just being culturally aware curriculum examples of kids and success from all areas. I mean, children of all different socioeconomic and racial categories need to see people that look like them and come from the same places as them being successful. And so being able to weave that into the curriculum and working together and learning from each other, sharing what success stories have had, because this is about pedagogy and how you are reaching children. It's not about what you're teaching. It's about how you're doing that and the relationships you're making with kids so that you can move them forward.
Troy, thank you for joining us.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for having me on here. I really appreciate it.
Troy Gunderson is former superintendent of the West Salem School District. Coming up, we meet with members of an advisory committee who are working to place a statue of Wisconsin civil rights icon Val Phillips at the state capitol. How would you like Wisconsin to honor Phillips' life and legacy? 800-642-1234. We'll discuss the trailblazer Val Phillips after this news update here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. With the stress of a global pandemic and the many things it's brought, economic struggles, grief, isolation, people who work with children and young adults know that they're struggling. But the same pandemic can make that harder to see. Madeline Fox reports school psychologists are worried that some kids are falling through the cracks, and students say it's been tougher to ask for help.
At Madison Memorial High School. He's also a musician, performing under the name Backwoods. When he's struggling with his mental health, he sometimes goes down to his basement studio to work on music.
Put all my school stuff away and mess around on my music and stuff and give myself some free roaming space.
But in a normal school year, when he went to school in person, Mark could also turn outward to other people.
I had this teacher who was kind of like a mentor for me through high school. I think being able to talk to him, we kind of just go by his office whenever during school was a big thing.
His school is all virtual now, so these kinds of casual drop-bys have to be more scheduled. According to the Centers for Disease Control, children's mental health emergencies have increased substantially over the course of the pandemic, and early research shows already increasing rates of depression and anxiety are likely going up even more.
We have a population of kids that even in like a normal year struggle to be engaged and struggle to like feel like school is worth the time and the energy.
That's Angela Lucas Foley, a school psychologist at Milwaukee Public Schools. School psychologists were stretched before the pandemic. The National Association of School Psychologists recommends a ratio of 500 students to one school psychologist. Wisconsin's ratio is 1,500 to one. And they've got some of the same challenges their students do: isolation, navigating technology, and they're often wrangling their own kids.
You add a pandemic on top of that, and yep, so you can write all the empty ones, write it in. Yep. Yep. And this is real life, helping my 6-year-old.
MPS is learning virtually, so the school psychologists are working with kids through texting, video chats, and phone calls. Lucas Foley says that can make it harder to see when kids are struggling, and harder to keep them talking and safe when they're in crisis. But even being in person doesn't solve the problem. It can ease kids' isolation, which helps a lot, but they're still dealing with their family's financial stress or worries about the disease, or mourning the milestones they've missed because they can't gather or celebrate like before.
There's a lot of grief right now, but a lot of students don't have the right language to express that, or they don't even know what it is that they're feeling.
Kisten Gillespie is a school psychologist in Lake Mills, which is doing classes in person. She says it's hard to tell when their older students are having trouble.
They're not displaying those outward behaviors that you sometimes see with the younger children that we work with. That's the most difficult piece, is catching the kids who are suffering internally and not necessarily making noise or talking to anybody.
And some of the younger students missed key pieces of their development during the spring closure, or just with fewer playdates and group gatherings, which Marquette Child Psychology professor Stephen Saunders says can put them behind on their development around making friends, learning to share, and learning to interact.
A 5-year-old is actually potentially at the level of a 4-year-old. A second grader is actually maybe functioning at the level of a kindergartner.
Experts and school psychologists say a lot of this is falling heavily on students who were already having trouble before the pandemic shook everything up. Here's Mark, the senior.
Mental health, I mean, it's always been like kind of a roller coaster for me, but things are going okay. School is going all right. I was kind of catching up, and it's been an even wilder roller coaster since the pandemic.
Even as the pandemic lets up, the effects could last a long time, says Saunders, the Marquette professor.
And we can't say, okay, now that's over. And it's going to continue to need to be a topic of conversation, a focus of intervention, so that we can ensure it truly is in the past tense.
A lot of things make a difference in how well children come out of this. Their support at home, their families' financial security, their access to mental health care. And almost all kids will need some help to get through this and to learn how to talk about it. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now we're talking about civil rights trailblazer Vell Phillips. A plan to place a statue of the late Vell Phillips at our state capitol is moving ahead. Just one of her barrier-breaking firsts, she was elected Secretary of State in 1978, the first Black candidate to win statewide office in Wisconsin. And last week, the State Capitol and Executive Residence Board approved creating a subcommittee that will finalize the design and location of the statue. What do you think about the prospects of her statue? It's 800-642-1234. Vell Phillips' son, Mike Phillips, is an attorney in Milwaukee and on the advisory committee. Mike, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
We also have Michael Johnson with us, president and CEO of Boys and Girls Club of Dane County. He is also on the statue committee. Michael, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me again. Appreciate it.
Well, Michael, let's start with you. Take us back to last summer in the height of the social justice protests, Black Lives Matter, the protests over police brutality. What did you do?
You know, last time, you know, I was on your show, we had talked about, you know, some of the challenges that we were facing, you know, throughout the country and right here, you know, in Madison. And, you know, I wanted to respond by, you know, listening to the concerns of young people, seeing some of the challenges that we faced. So we ended up raising some money to, you know, help support some of the activists and some of the positive efforts they wanted to achieve. But we also raised $250,000 to support those businesses that had been looted downtown. And about a day after, you know, some of the buildings had been destroyed, we end up sending 3,000 volunteers to clean up our downtown area. Now, with that being said, I also, you know, heard concerns from young people throughout the state that there was no representation of people of color at the state capitol. So I called the governor's office to confirm that that was the case. And then we immediately put together a list of community leaders who would think who would be the appropriate person to have representation at the state capitol. 2 weeks later, after consulting with several people, I wrote a letter to the executive residency board. I also wrote a letter to the governor asking them to support a statue of Vell Phillips. The governor responded right away and supported the idea. I ended up asking, I called Mike. I didn't know Mike prior to this and asked if he would support being a part of this committee. I asked Dave Andres, who's a lead attorney at American Family Insurance, to chair it. And since the formation of this phenomenal group that we have, which now include the mayor of Milwaukee, Alder Cox, who is the alder in the 6th District, Milwaukee, and several other leaders across the state. We've so far raised $25,000 with a lead gift from the Wisconsin State Bar. We've gotten a letter of support from the Common Council, and you already announced that the Executive Residency Board has developed a committee to work with our task force to see what the next steps are.
Mike, I know we're having a bit of trouble with your line. I'm wondering, you know, your mother accomplished so much in her 95 years. What does this statue signify to you?
Wow, it signifies a lot, certainly a bit of a turning point now, given the times that we're living in. I know it was very difficult at the Capitol in the summer, but it's been difficult all over this country this past summer. And my mom, to me, is, and I think to the state of Wisconsin, is representative of sort of everyone. She's inclusive. She fought for rights, but she not just for African Americans. She fought for rights for Latinos, for all people, white, brown, black, Asian. She fought for everyone, and that seems to resonate today even louder.
I'm wondering, you know, a summer of protests with broad public support for racial justice protests happening all over the nation. Would Vel Phillips have been out there?
Would she have been out there? Yeah. I'd have been pushing her in a wheelchair, right? She would have, certainly. I'd have borrowed a megaphone, or someone would have, she would have commandeered a megaphone, and she would be right there, although small, blasting out over into the crowd. Oh yeah, she was born for a moment like this.
Mm. So, Michael Johnson, I'm wondering, as you look at getting this statue to move forward, are there any challenges? What is ahead of you?
Cost, you know, $241,000 to be able to, you know, erect this statue, and we believe, you know, based on her history in our state, that we will easily, you know, raise those funds. So, getting people, a bunch of people, to give us a bunch of small donations to support this effort. And then our next step is to, you know, work with the Executive Residency Board and our task force and DOA to make sure that this happened. Our committee was very, very pleased about what transpired at the last meeting. We think that they made the right decision by forming a subcommittee to work with us, you know, on the details. But let me just point out, because I think this is important for people who may not know of Vail's track record. Can I spend just 2 minutes?
Absolutely.
Just briefing your listeners about Vail. In 1951, Vail became the first African-American woman to graduate from UW-Madison Law School. And that was in 1951. In 1956, she became the first woman and the first African-American on the County Council of Milwaukee. Then in 1958, she was elected as the first African-American to have a seat back in 1958 on the Democratic National Committee. Then in 1968, the Common Council approved a desegregation law that was proposed by Vail to outlaw housing discrimination after she fought almost a half a decade to make that happen. And then in 1978, she went on to become the first African-American woman to become a judge in Wisconsin and later made history as the first African-American woman elected in the United States of America in a statewide executive office. And then in 1979, a lot of people don't know this, she actually served as governor for a day in the state of Wisconsin.
It wasn't a weekend.
Well, it was actually over a weekend,
yes.
Because the governor and the lieutenant governor had to attend the Republican National Convention. So when you look at her track record, when you look at her history, when you look at the things that she accomplished in this state, we could not think of a better person that deserved this sort of reputation. And we believe that it is good for not only Black kids and kids of color, but for white kids to learn about her history, to learn that we just yesterday put out a letter to teachers and educators about the history of Black Wisconsinites. And there's so much history in this state that date all the way back 180 years ago. And it is important for kids and young people and families across the state to understand that history. And we believe that this will happen. We hope it will happen. And we're going to do everything that we can to ensure that this happens.
Mike Phillips. Mike Phillips, I'm wondering, you know, what an incredible timeline. What have you thought about the inscription? What would the inscription on the statue say?
Boy, that's something that's in work.
Okay.
The inscription, it'd be hard to approximate right now.
We're talking with Vel Phillips' son, Mike Phillips, who is on the subcommittee creating the plan to erect a statue of the Wisconsin Civil Rights Trailblazer. Michael Johnson sits on the committee as well. He's CEO of Boys and Girls Club of Dane County. Did you ever meet or work with Vel Phillips when she was an alderwoman, a judge, secretary of state? What do you remember most about her? Why do you think there isn't a statue honoring a person of color from Wisconsin's history at the state capitol? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing the plan to erect a new statue at the state capitol of the late barrier-breaking African-American lawmaker from Milwaukee, Vel Phillips. She died in 2018. Here she is in 1971, becoming the first black judge in Wisconsin.
I shall remember for a very long time this morning, because I am sure that there will be many times when remembering your good faith, your confidence in my ability, and your sincere wishes for my success will be like water to a thirsty traveler.
Like water to a thirsty traveler. That's from the 2015 PBS Wisconsin documentary. How do you remember Vel Phillips? 800-642-1234. Vel Phillips' son, attorney Mike Phillips, sits on the subcommittee creating the plan for the statue. We also have Michael Johnson, CEO of Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, also on the planning committee. Mike Phillips, let's talk fair housing for a moment. Milwaukee subdivisions, the vast majority, had been planned out with regulations prohibiting the sale of property to people of color. And here comes Vel Phillips, who introduced the housing ordinance in 1962, 5 years before fair housing marches. What kept her trying when her bill was defeated?
let's see. My dad, I would say, was a huge influence in that. My father, my mother and father, they were both lawyers. They were actually the first husband and wife team admitted to the bar in the federal bar, the Western District of District Court of Wisconsin. They opened a law firm, just Phillips and Phillips. And while my mom used it as sort of a springboard into politics, my dad, he was a working attorney, man. He built the largest African-American law firm in the state, Phillips, Phillips, Gambrell, Jones, and Stamper at its height. And my father, my mom, bless her heart, she was a great voice and a great visionary, but it was my father who sort of brought the nuts and bolts of inequity to her. I mean, she saw it through him, because my father was out there representing some of the poorest people around, going to their neighborhoods, going to their houses, going to jail. My father used to buy cornucopias. I don't know if you know what those Thanksgiving.
Sure.
Yeah, he used to buy cornucopias for defendants that he couldn't get out for the holidays. And we would go around, my dad and me, delivering these to just some of the very, very poor conditioned people. And these stories, you know, my mom was there. We'd filter in. Sometimes she was there. I mean, it was through my father in some ways that she saw some of the worst.
She was the 13th District Children's Court Judge, first woman and African-American to hold this post. And she said, the words juvenile justice needed to be part of the building when the Milwaukee County Children's Court Center was named after her. What did she see in juvenile justice and kids not being treated fairly?
Oh, I think she saw the same thing that we all see. In the latter part of my legal career, I was an assistant district attorney here in Milwaukee. And I can tell you that there is there is difficulty in equal treatment. It's not the sort of thing that is obvious, but it's the sort of thing that you see when you're charging people. And one of the reasons I took the job was to address what I perceived as some of the inequities. And inequities, I think, are heavier when they are imposed on younger people, kids. Kids feel them worse. I think all kids deserve a break. My mom always thought so. And she fought for it, as did I.
I'm wondering, Michael, what do you think the statue will look like? Have you thought about what it will be made of?
Talking to Michael or me? We're both Mikes.
Yeah, Michael Johnson, I'm sorry.
Yeah, so I would say, you know, we have an initial rendering that was commissioned by, you know, a vendor through the DOA, but I think it's still too early, you know, in the process. We want to make sure that Michael Phillips, you know, and his family get an opportunity to, you know, give input along with the community. But we want to make sure that the statue at least will represent what she represented. And we also wanted to be consistent with what the other statues look like in terms of dimension and size. That's at the Capitol, you know, right now. And DOA would have to give us some guidance around that. You know, this is not something that we specialize in. I've never in my career, I've always raised money for kids.
Yeah.
So I've never, you know, raised money for, you know, anything like this. So we're going to ask people who are, you know, qualified in this space, have history doing these kinds of things. And there are people that's on our committee that has this kind of experience. And so we will tap into their intellectual capital to make sure that we make the right decisions. And I also applaud DOA. They have some great people in their shop that have done this before. And we just want to make sure that it represent, you know, who she is. I also want to point out that our committee also supports the restoration of the Hague and the Four statues. You know, we want those statues back up as well. And our committee also, if we have to, would also, you know, support making sure that that happens, you know, financially. And I also think this opens up the door that, you know, beyond, you know, Vail, at, you know, the committee is going to have to decide how do you make sure there's other representation. And we have some ideas, you know, around that could be done in a very, you know, strategic way. But our residents across the state need to feel the diversity and the mm-hmm. fabric of what our state represents. And right now, there's no representation.
Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
That was Michael Johnson, president and CEO of Boys and Girls Club of Dane County, on an advisory committee created to explore placing a statue of civil rights icon Vail Phillips at the state capitol, and Vail Phillips' son, Mike Phillips, an attorney in Milwaukee, on the committee. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.